The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody.
This might be my favorite author interview here at the library ever.
Oh, thank you.
I mean that, y'all. This is so dope. Look at all these people in here.
Right. On a Monday night.
On a Monday night. On a football night,
right.
Too.
Monday night, football night, and all these folks got to go to work tomorrow. They got jobs.
That's true.
They teachers.
Oh, and this is love, man. This is love. I have never, we do events like this all the time at the library and Uncle Bobby's partners, and I do a few of these, maybe one a month or so, and I've never seen this kind of energy. It was like a family reunion coming in here. And you're the first author to actually hang down here with the people and talk and take pictures and show love and engage the whole time. That means a lot. Let me put my old copy away, and the fancy one, the hard. Bettina sent me one like 9 months ago, small flex, and it was so good. This is an incredible book, and I hope you know that. That was the last thing I'm gonna say. I had the benefit of meeting you first as a graduate student, which makes me feel a little old. But as a graduate student, we met at the AERA conference, education conference, and you were doing work on hip hop. Black girlhood.
That's right.
And you were on fire then. Then you went and got a good job.
You know, got that good.
You did.
Little insurance, little coverage.
And you stayed on fire. You know, some people wait to tenure to be on fire, and then they get tenure and find another excuse to not do the work that needs to be done. But you did the work that needed to be done before tenure, during tenure, after tenure. You put out an amazing book. Some people make the same book over and over again, just keep getting money. No, you said, I'm going to change the topic, raise the stakes intellectually, politically. This book is just so good, and I'm so proud of you. And I just want to say that.
Thank you.
Your brother, I love you, and I'm so proud of you.
Thank you, Mike. That means a lot coming from you.
So let me start with the question I ask most authors, if they're interesting. Why do people keep their phones on in a public event, you know?
That's a fact.
So I was pondered that for years, right? And then my second question.
Follow up.
Is why this book, why now?
So, first, thank you all for coming out tonight. Y'all look good. Y'all look amazing. Thank you. Really feel honored to be here in front of y'all talking about education on a Monday night with my brother. Who I admire so much. I'll just say this really quickly. When I was young, doc student, had no clue what I was going to do, there were two people who I modeled my career after, looked at their CVs, and that was Rich Milner and you. And so I'm just, you got this burning question. They still, nobody answered that burning question. So it's really an honor to be here. Why write this book? Honestly, I've been trying to write this book for a very long time. If anybody knows me, I'm from Rochester, New York. I take that seriously, being from Rochester, New York, because we hate New Yorkers. Because when you say you're from Rochester, New York, you say upstate, New Yorkers are like, Yonkers? Mount Vernon? Like, they can't even imagine what's up there.
So I'm,
you can go 8 miles outside the city. Like, they can't even understand that. So you gotta, like, Canada to help them understand where you're from. But I went to a big high school. We talk about I had a plane inside my high school. It was like 2,000 kids, a vocational high school. It was huge. And the freshman class was between 600, 700 kids.
Wow.
So 14 years old, it's 700 of us. We young, we think we know everything. Sadly, I started ninth grade with a curl. You know, I was out there. By the end of the week, I didn't have one. That's how bad they got on me. And I appreciate that. 4 years later, I graduate. There's about 120 of us who graduate. So that means we have like a 25% graduation rate. And I remember walking across the stage thinking to myself, where the hell is everybody? Like, I remember distinctly, like, it's a big auditorium. And we barely packing this thing. Where is everybody? And so, I don't think it's a coincidence I become an educator. I don't think it's a coincidence that I start to want to examine and look at educational policy and my generation and the school experiences of kids like me, because I've always been wanted to know, where did all my classmates go? Where did all my friends go? What happened to 550 kids? Like, where did they go? And so it's always been a lingering question since I was 17 years old.
Those children, those youth, those students who don't make it across the graduation stage, they go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And something pushes them in that
That's
direction.
Right.
A big part of your book is about telling us those forces that push mm-hmm. them in those directions. You start the book with some storytelling, and the book is filled with amazing stories. But you kind of start with one that involves you,
mm-hmm.
some of your peers, some of your teammates.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that journey and how that not only helps you form this idea of what it means to be punished for dreaming,
mm-hmm.
or punished, period, right? But also the kind of intellectual trajectory of the book.
Yeah, so, you know, if you books, academics, all that's great, but I'm a ball player. Like, let's not get it twisted. I love basketball. That is my identity. That's who I am. And high school basketball star, like, that's me. I'm averaging a ton of points. 31 points a game. Like, I'm not playing. This book shit is cute, but I can shoot that basketball. Like, I want to be clear. And so my freshman year again, I come in, I'm ready. You know, it's love and basketball. I'm trying to take every senior spot. Like, I'm talking mad trash. And we have a girl on our basketball team. Her name is Zukiya Van Hoos. She could dribble the ball like it was strung to her hand, had the freshest sneakers, all the jokes. I want to be Zook. Like, she's everything. She's 18, I'm 14. That's who I want to be. And by the end of the season, right before the playoffs, there's this big scandal that Zook and some other male basketball players have not been going to class, allegedly, and they take all our games away. So we're like 22-1. We end the season like 1-22. And so at Zook disciplinary hearing, they're telling her all the things that she did and all the things she did not do, and she punches a teacher. You hear over the intercom, Van Hoos on the loose, Van Hoos on the loose. So we're all like, what's going on? What's happening? I find out years later that Zook was she was chokehold and pushed down by a teacher in maybe 7th, 8th grade. No teacher had ever told her that she was smart. She didn't have any teachers that she could remember that really made an impact on her. She told me she was no child left behind before no child left behind, and that C's and D's get degrees. And I saw the way she was disposed of. A star basketball player, had the whole world in her hand, was going to go to any top school in the country, and then it was over just like that. She made that mistake, and it was over, and she was punished. And that was my cautionary tale. Like, that's the person I wanted to be. Zook wasn't going to class, I wasn't going to class. Zook was skipping, I was skipping. And it just changed my whole trajectory, because I saw how easily you make one mistake, they will throw you away. They don't care if you're a basketball star, they don't care how many points you score, you were done. And I just, that experience has stayed with me. And to this day, if you talk to Zook right now, you know, we are really good friends, we all get together, she'll tell you real quick, you only here because of me, love. She'll tell me right now, you only here because of me. You only write these books because she plays no jokes with my life trajectory because of her. And she's right, right? It's hurtful to know that so much of what I was able to do is because of her mistakes, yeah. And because how she was punished for just being a child, for being, not having, being able to control her temper, not understanding that her mother was gone, her father was out of her life, she was living with her grand, like all those things, that punch that she threw was a punch for so much, not just that teacher that day.
Yeah. One of the themes that cuts through the whole book for me is this idea of disposability.
Mm-hmm.
Our children are easy to throw away in the minds of the state, in the minds of the school system. Part of what your book gets at, to me, is the policy decisions
mm-hmm.
that make this happen. It's not just that in every school there's a bunch of messed up teachers. It's not that in every school there's a bunch of messed up administrators. Not every school has a bad disciplinary policy or mm-hmm. what have you. It's that there's a set of reforms that allow this to happen.
Yeah.
And you even implicate the idea of reform itself
mm-hmm.
as part of the problem. Talk to me about some of these. I'm using the story you just told, for example. The response to a child who does an act of harm is not to support them, not to figure out what the problem is, but to figure out how to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Right. You talk about that as being part of a carceral logic and a carceral state and the punishment state. Talk to me a little bit about how carcerality, which is a term that comes up in a couple of your chapters thoroughly, plays into how we think about the way black kids are treated.
Yeah, so I want to be very honest. You know, when I wrote We Want to Do More Than Survive, I modeled that book off of Nobody. I think I told you that. Because it was such an amazing book, the way you framed it. And so I really wanted to talk about carcerality as inevitable, right? For black folks in this country, there is no prison to school pipeline. You know, there is no prison. You sitting in it. The very idea of how this society functions for black folks is carceral. So we look at schooling, we can look, you know, we talk about metal detectors and dogs and police, right? And those are the most visceral ways we talk about carcerality. But the very structure of how schools are set up are carceral. Even the way we talk to children are carceral. You're either gonna be dead or you're gonna be like, what do we talk? How do we talk to children?
Did y'all catch that? I'm sorry, that's real. You say school don't just lead you to the prison, school itself forms as a type of.
Yes, you sitting in it. Like all the ways in which Zook, all the stories I tell in the book, it's not about we go from here to here to here. You're already in it. Exit exams, testing, all the ways in which school is functioning. So there is no prison to pipeline. It's inevitable. And not only that, the way in which we are seen and presumed guilty. There is no innocence for us. That's carcerality. So what I was trying to do in the book is just to talk about how school reform and crime reform, particularly in the 80s and 90s, merged. And they became one and the same.
One of the ways, maybe the primary way for education that this merger happens is through a very interesting, world-changing document, at least country-changing document, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a Nation at Risk.
Nation at Risk.
What is a Nation at Risk? It's a centerpiece of your book. Mm-hmm. What is it? How does it get us where we are now?
So a Nation at Risk is a 36, 35-page report. Like, it's not this robust thing. But what it does is it creates a crisis. And I think if you're watching education or just watching how politics play out over the last, you know, 70 years, it's about them creating a crisis, no data for the crisis, and then they want to come in and reform the crisis that they created. So Nation at Risk. So 1978, 1979, the right is trying to say that public education is failing, public education is no good, we don't really need public education, let's privatize this thing, right? They're still mad after Brown versus the Board of Education. So by 1980, they got their boy, which is Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan comes in, 1982, declares a war on drugs, which you know is a war on black people. By 1983, Ronald Reagan declares a nation at risk, right? And this nation at risk is this report. Now, this report uses all the lies and misleading data that they had already written in the late 70s, early 80s. And they just lump it into this report. It was already written with misleading data. Lies, if you want to just be clear about it. And then it says that this country's education system is failing so badly it could cause war. Like this warmongering language. They go on a tour talking about the failure of public education in this country. 1983 is the same year that we get DARE. What is the DARE program? The DARE program says there's good folks and there's bad folks, and those bad folks got to go. You got to arrest them. They got to disappear. It also says, listen, you snitch on your parents, you get a keychain or a t-shirt. Snitch on your parents, snitch on your community. Right. Now, who creates the DARE program? The DARE program is created by Daryl Gates. Who is Daryl Gates? He is the police chief during the Rodney King attempted execution. And also the same police chief that said black folks have different esophagus, so it's okay to put us in the chokehold. That is the man who creates the DARE program. 1984, Reagan comes out with another report with misleading data. That's data taken from the 70s called Chaos in the Classroom. Now, this report says that these students are so rude and out of control that we need police in schools. So you start to see policy after policy. Now, the backdrop of all of this is broken window theory, stop and frisk, three strikes. Like, you start to see all of these ways in which black people are being criminalized outside of the classroom, but all that stuff is happening inside the classroom as well. And the policies and the reforms start to merge. And by 1989, they even got a theme song, Cops. Right? 1994, 1994 is the bell curve where they say that black folks are inherently inferior. And by 1996, you have the perfect storm of the language. Hillary Clinton comes on TV and says, we have super predators. So you have super predators, you got crack babies, you got thugs, you got education reform and crime reform, you got chaos in the classroom. These are all manufactured crises. Little to no data, public outrage, and you're making it seem as though this public entity can't be trusted, which is public education. So it's not, if you understand the trajectory of that, you understand how we get to where we are right now in 2023. You don't need data, you just need to show chaos. You just need to show that there's a crisis. And that's what we're seeing. So when I was writing a book, I didn't know I was writing this history to right now. I was just having fun. And then I was like, oh, this is how we got here. So it was really telling to see throughout history how they've used reform as a way in which to fix a crisis that they created and then get their children jobs off the crisis that they created, aka Teach for America and all this other crap that they have.
I'm glad you went there. All the... Woo, that'll preach. Folk will be running around the room in a minute. Should have bought a Honda. I was thinking about, as you were talking just now, I was thinking about my friend Naomi Klein.
Yeah.
And this idea of the shock doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you talk about crisis, one thing the West is able to do, one thing capitalism is able to do, is find a way to profit off a crisis.
That's right.
And as you pointed out, crises that they often create.
That's right.
So when we see the emergence of TFA, when we see the emergence of these policy reforms, No Child Left Behind, mm-hmm. all the way up to Race to the Top, all mm-hmm. of them, right, what you talk about in the book, to what extent are those movements, those policy reforms, not just bound up in a fake crisis, but also bound up in economic interests, particularly of the elite, of the powerful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a chapter in the book called Leave No Entrepreneur Behind. And so... Man, you gotta love black folks.
Yeah, you I know, right?
So, you know, in the book, what I really try hard is to show the links between the way in which they profit off this idea that public education is failing. And so you see it time and time again. And, you know, this state is a great example of how folks have profited off of the very idea that the schools are failing. So we could close the schools and then give all this money to private entities to do absolutely nothing. And so you see it over and over and over again. And so we have to be able to understand that these people are entrepreneurs. And what is the goal of an entrepreneur? To fail. Right? Failure is a part of being an entrepreneur. You have to fail. You got to fail up, they hope. But the conversation is, who do they get to fail with? They fail with our babies. Then close us down, tell us that we're deficient and got an achievement gap as they go off and take all our money. And so the very idea from Teach for America to all of these other, you know, alternative routes to education, all these ways in which they allow folks who have no experience, don't know what they're doing, unproven measures, and what they would not send their children to then come into our communities and experiment on our babies and get paid doing
mm-hmm.
it. And so we got to be clear, you know, and that's why I start the book off called Name Names. We have to name names, because if you can't name your oppressor, then you don't know who's doing it to you. So a big part of the book for me was to name names, to call them out, to say these are the individuals, and kind of do the, like, follow the money.
Yeah.
Because if you follow the money, then you can see just how these folks are egregious. Data, we always talk about data, data, data. Their data is terrible. Their success rates, graduation rates are, deplorable. And got the audacity to be looking at us like, what are y'all doing? Give us the same money and the same funding that you gave them. And for TFA, you know, anybody asked me, like, you know, what's your problem with Teach for America? I said, listen, it's not hard to understand. Like, people act like this is mind-blowing. Right? Would you let your child sit in a classroom with somebody who has 6 weeks of training? No. Okay, then. What's the problem?
Right.
Right, would you go to a doctor that has 6 weeks of training? Let somebody build your house that has 6 weeks of training? Just because they got a good heart and they're thoughtful? What? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And then it's the kids who need the most, who get the least, under this whole entrepreneur model. And so we have to be able to understand how, and this is, you know, people say, you know, I get down on charter schools. I'm not down on charter schools, but I want charter school people to understand you are part of a larger conversation that I don't think you are aware of. I don't think you are aware that you are in the portfolios of these conglomerates, hedge fund operators, right? You're in the portfolios of them. So even though there's some great charter schools, there's some great public schools, I'm not dissing charter schools, but what I'm saying is understand you are part of a larger picture of destruction of public education, even though you're doing good work within that system.
There are people who would say to you, that's why we want to hold everybody accountable.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have accountability measures.
Yeah.
That's why we want these tests so that we can show that the schools aren't treating your kids right, y'all kids right. And once the tests show that they're not doing it right, we can have some reforms to fix it. But we need good data. We need accountability. We need testing that's uniform so we can have standardization and good standards for everybody. What say you, Dr. Love?
First, who standards? When you come up with these standards, will black folks and folks of color be anywhere in the room? Where our curriculum, where our history, where our culture, and if Goldie Muhammad's not in the room, don't talk about standards with me. So there we go. And second of all, you know, I'm not against testing. I think kids should be tested. I think we should know where kids are standing. But what I don't want is big business and testing.
Yeah.
Right? That's what this shouldn't be a billion-dollar industry where you are profiting off of. Urban legend is making prisons off of. Like, it shouldn't be that. So we need tests. Those tests maybe should be in-house, maybe should be district-wide, and yes, should lead to teachers being informed about what students do or don't know. We also don't need tests. Like, you know, I'm from New York. The Regents is ridiculous. That is a straight-up Ponzi scheme. Like, how am I in school 13 years, and here I am in the 12th hour, and you say, well, you can't graduate because you didn't pass this test. Like, you come on, man. And then it's deprofessionalizing the teachers. And so I'm all for standards. Who standards? I'm all for testing, but I want big business and high-stakes standardized testing out of education. And if we talk about data, they don't have any data. They don't have any data that says these tests make this happen. We can say these tests cause carcerality. We know if you have exit exams, a rate of carcerality goes up by 14 to 13%. So we have so much data that talks about anxiety for children, test anxiety, carcerality. That's data. They don't want to talk about that.
They don't want to talk about that.
They don't want to talk about that data.
You know, I want to talk about KIPP for a minute. Y'all know about KIPP. I was trying to go with themes, but I can't leave KIPP. KIPP got to get a little bit of critique. Yeah. You got a whole talk to us about KIPP, what KIPP is, what KIPP ain't, because you got a chapter on this that lights KIPP on fire.
So I can't talk about it now, but we're gonna tell the story. We're gonna tell the story.
Fair enough.
So Teach for America, come up again. Two white boys who didn't know what they were doing in the classroom. Struggling in the classroom, and they will admit this. There's video after video of them saying, we were struggling in the classroom, we didn't know what we were doing, but we kept hearing this woman who could sing, who could rap, who could play the piano, who could draw. She could do it all, baby. Her name was Harriet Ball. She could do it all. You name it. She won Teacher of the Year over and over and over and over again. She won Teacher of the Year so many times, they stopped giving her Teacher of the Year just because they said somebody else has to have it. And she quit right on the spot. That's how good of a teacher she was. And these two white boys said, Miss Ball, can we sit at your feet? Can we come in your classroom? Can we watch? Can we learn your chants? Can we learn what you do? And being a good... Wild guess she was black. And being a black Southern Christian lady from Houston, Texas, she says, come on, baby. Come on, you can sit at my feet, come on. And 2 years, they sat at Miss Ball's feet. They watched her, they learned her chants, they learned the dances, they learned all the things the kids did. And she had a song called Knowledge is Power. Read, baby, read. You got to get that knowledge, you got to get that power, and you got to get that money.
Good
acronym. That was her song. They leave, and they go off to create KIPP. What is KIPP? knowledge is power. Yes.
And Sato said, what?
Knowledge is power.
You try to tell me a black woman created something and white people exploited it, stole it, and sold it. That's what you try to tell me.
I mean, it's a farce.
Wow.
First
time for everything.
And they, all of it. And even in, they have even acknowledged that they took the money part of the song out because they wanted to get funders. They've even acknowledged that. There's book testimony of all of them. So I've always been fascinated with Mrs. Ball. I had the honor and the privilege of being a student of Asa Hillard. If you don't know who Asa Hillard is, you better check him out. He was a legend before he made his transition. He's a legend. And one of my first doc classes, he would go around the country and he would interview and videotape master teachers, what he calls them. And so one day he rolls out like his little VHS player or whatever. He pops in a tape of Harriet. And I'm like, who is this lady? She rapping. Like, this is before hip hop was like, she rapping. And I was like, oh my word. So I always wanted to tell her story. And my doc students found her kids online and met with them, talked with them, and they allowed me to tell their mother's story. Wow. So I'm really happy that it's getting out there. Now, what's even more is, of course, we had to lawyer up. So when you write a book like this, lawyers get involved. And so we had to send Kip what we were working on and what was happening. Kip come back and says, they're not answering any of my questions. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, well, we'll keep going. I don't know what got in their back, but a few days later, they said, we want to answer some, we want a statement. So I guess somebody told you might want to answer Dr. Love's question. So I sent them, and in the back of the book is all the questions I sent them. Do you have a contract with Ms. Ball? Do you have an invoice of anything you paid Ms. Ball? Do you have copyrights for her lyrics? These two white boys went on the Oprah show. Ms. Ball was home crying. They had a video of her. But she was on the couch at home crying. Now remember, this is Oprah. It's a black woman at this time period. There's nothing more special than being on the Oprah Winfrey show.
Nothing.
And they're on the couch with Oprah, and she had the house in Houston crying. I asked them, did you invite her? Why wasn't she on the show? I sent them about 10 or 12 questions. They sent me back a statement. We love Ms. Ball. Ms. Ball was foundational. I didn't ask you how much you loved her. I didn't ask you I asked you, did you pay this woman? Do you have copyrights to her song? And if you can you prove it?
Right.
Nothing. And so it's in her kids' hands now.
Thank you for putting a spotlight on that. Because, see, now what we can do is apply pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you write a book like this that draws attention to it, and then it's our responsibility, every single one of us, to make sure that we get justice for that sister and for black people around the world for whom this is an ordinary experience.
So what you just said, Ms. Ball would say, ape, apply pressure every day. She said, you ape, you apply pressure every day. If you go online, you see some of her videos, it's unbelievable the type of teacher she was. And she died in 2011, trying to open up her own school where they had over 200 schools. And she, at the end of her life, she was, her health had deteriorated. She was disabled. She had a walker. She was still teaching. And the story goes that, you know, they asked, she was doing a lot of training for them, but never was made a partner, never. There's no school named after Harriet Ball. I asked them why there's no school named after Harriet Ball. They said all KIPP schools are independent and they can name them whatever they want to name them. So you know, it's foolishness, but I'm just so happy that I got to tell the story. I'm so happy that our kids are happy with what's in the book, and there's some folks who are interested in telling her story.
Yeah, man, this is powerful. I want to ask you a question about the current educational debates. Another crisis, right? There's always a moral crisis, intellectual crisis. This one is about how race has taken up in educational discourse. We've seen a range of policy reforms in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. not to stop violence in schools, not to mm-hmm. increase our math outcomes, not to increase our numeracy, not to enhance our literacy, but to stop that pesky race mm-hmm. talk, to get the wokeness mm-hmm. out of our schools. How do you make sense of, and I know in the book you talk about this, you talk about, there's two particular things that you talk about that are interesting to me. One is that you engage the discourse around critical race theory. You also take up this DEI question. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with the critical race stuff. What do you make of it, and how can we, also what can we do? Because there's also the what do we do question, right? Our racial discourse is under attack. We can't even talk to kids about being black. We can't talk to kids about history. Mm-hmm. We can't talk to kids about being queer. We can't, I mean, the world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller for us in terms of our curricular purview. Why, how, and what do we do about it?
What I try to frame in the book is that what we are experiencing now is educational white rage. And that's using the work of Carol Anderson out of Emory University, who I think is just, her book, White Rage, I think is masterful. Yeah. Because what she says is that too often we think of the violence of racism as racism. Like we get stuck on a January 6th. But she says the racism that we don't talk about enough is how they legislate their racism. Yeah. Right? How you can make your racism law. How you can make your racism a policy, a book ban. And that's what we're watching right now, is we're watching them legislate their racism. But what Carol Anderson also says is that you will always see white rage when you see black achievement. The trigger of white rage is black achievement. So if the uprisings of 20 and 21, of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, those uprisings, well, here we are. Right? This is where we are. I hope we didn't think that we were going to take to the streets and they weren't going to do anything in return, but they are going to legislate it. And so I think we're watching right now the white rage that we typically see in other places in education. But I also want to be clear, is I don't want to see what's happening in education with critical race theory as an isolated event.
Right.
So if you understand women's rights on the chopping block, affirmative action on the chopping block, public education, queer folks, it's all one. The same groups are doing the same, they're the same groups. And so if you look at what the Washington Post did May 23rd of 2023, they did this analysis of the book bans, and they found that 60% of all book bans were submitted by 10 individuals.
Yep.
So this is
and they don't be moms in school.
No.
Despite being moms for liberty, like, which gives you this idea, it's concerned parents who are just worried about what their kids are learning in school. No.
These are well-funded, well-organized organizations. And so we got to be very clear about it. And so this is not something that's like taking over. They will make it seem like it's taking over the country. They will use the media conglomerates to say critical race theory over and over and over again so it becomes part of the American lexicon. But the average person don't know what the hell they talking about. Like, what? That's why when you ask them, well, what is it? I don't know, but it got to go. They don't know. But again, you manufacture a crisis. And so, but I also want people to understand the attack on critical race theory, yes, is an attack on black history. Yes, is an attack on black people. But we are collateral damage. And to take us out, that's okay. The real goal is to privatize education. And so if you can sow distrust into this public good, and you can make the people believe that this public good is no longer working, it can no longer be trusted, and this public good has to go, and they're going to say, well, what's this? We can't trust public education. We can't trust these teachers anymore. They're all on their political left soapboxes. No receipts. And let's be clear. If critical race theory is taking over education, who's doing it? White women are 88% of the teaching force.
It's a great point.
If it's running rapid, it's them.
Right.
It's like Moms of Liberty against each other. What are y'all talking about? Black males make up less than 2% of the teaching population. Black women are like 6%. So if critical race theory is taking over, white folks are doing it.
Solid point.
Those numbers, if you think about that, and you think about it, they've had almost 125 laws passed. Mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. would have to think that it was everywhere.
Right.
So you would have to think that these 88% of white women are doing it, for almost 150 laws to be created.
Yeah.
The math ain't mathing.
It is not mathing. It is not mathing. Look, there's going to be time for questions in just a moment, so I want you all to prepare your questions now. Questions. Questions. They end in a question mark. Give you a minute to work that out. Educational reparations.
Yeah.
I think it's an important piece of your book, and for me, maybe the most profound intervention of a book that has a lot of them.
Thank you.
For two reasons. One, because you have a concrete policy ask, which is something that most scholars don't do. We're good at saying problems, we're good at magnifying problems, giving the history of problems, but not actually saying, well, what can we do to leave the world better than we found it? You give a very concrete one. But you also don't just push the education conversation, you also push the reparations conversation. Mm-hmm. Because you force us to complicate and ultimately reimagine what reparations could look like. Not to say that we don't need money.
Oh, no.
Right? Because it's clear, sometimes white people like to reimagine a way out of giving us what we need, right? So it's not like, well, reimagine reparations.
Don't reimagine a check.
Right.
But don't reimagine that check.
Still want the check.
Right.
But in addition, mm-hmm. it's a more complicated enterprise. Talk to me about why we need educational reparations. Or not even that, because we know why, right? The book is about why. What do educational reparations look like, and how do we make that happen?
What I tried to do in the book is I tried to, like, make people believe in something. So the first 10 chapters is all these stories, all these people, all this reform. And it's like, okay, all right, shit is fucked up. Like, okay, I believe her. Okay, this will happen to these people. This reform is not just about these policies, but actually real people. Okay, we vibing this whole time. Now, chapter 11 is like, well, you got to see black people. You got to love black people. You got to celebrate us. Okay. Then what's the solution? So if you believe me for the last 11 chapters, well, maybe you'll stick around for like a solution. And then if you believe that what I've been outlining is actual harm, then maybe we could talk about repair. And another word for reparations is repair.
That's right.
So I was really trying to think about what repair could be. And so I want to be clear. It was three black women and a group of black women economists who really helped me. So we started meeting, you know, 2 years, 3 years ago on Zoom, right when the pandemic hit. And we met every month. They started meeting twice a month, and they were just amazing. And we started to talk about what a justice formula would be for schools. And that became just, it couldn't be done. I would have never finished the book. And we tried to come up with a justice formula would be for school funding. That's where it started. I said, well, what about reparations? And we started meeting with scholars in reparations, and they started telling us what they thought and how we got it. And it was Hope Wilanowski, who was a black woman. Her name don't sound black, but she's a black woman. It was Nzinga Burris and Shanice Campbell. And these were the three.
She's black.
And these are the three black women who really helped me. And then one Saturday, one weekend, they all came to my house. My wife was upstairs cooking. I'm going up and downstairs just trying to get what they need. And they started doing some Hidden Figures type of shit. And I'm just like, and they started calculating like actual categories of harm. And so from the whole 2 years, we had these six categories of harm, and they started calculating it. I was like, oh, we got numbers. And so these six categories come up to $2 trillion just for my generation, just 40 years. And so I'll give you some examples. In 2010, there were over 100,000 black students who qualified for AP, had the grades for AP, the test scores for AP, but there was no AP at their class, no teacher who can take AP, so they were not enrolled in AP. Now, those 100,000 students or so, if they go, those who go to college, they will pay more in their tuition because they could, that's reparations, right? I'm paying more because I was systematically denied this opportunity. Also, in New York, you can suspend a kid up to 120 days. It's only 180 days in a school year. Now, when you suspend a kid, do you suspend that kid and they get lunch and breakfast and tutors? They don't get anything. But that's their money. Everybody gets paid. The police officer get paid. The principal get paid. Everybody gets paid. That kid ain't been in school in 50 days, but everybody gets paid, and that's their money. What if when we suspend kids, they went home with a check? I bet we won't suspend black kids like that. Or the data says that if you are a young black boy from a low-income home and you have two black teachers, just two black teachers, the likelihood that you will go graduate and go off to college increases to 32%. So we have black boys who have never gone through their whole K through 12 without a black teacher and were pushed out. So now you are impacting my learning and earning lifelong potential. We know that if you don't graduate high school and you graduate high school, there is almost of a $250,000 difference. That's harm. And so I think for me, it was to not just say these are data points of harm, but to say if we believe that they are harm, then what is repair? Because you are impacting my life, my children's life, what kind of job I can have, what kind of insurance I can have, what my grandkids will have. You are impacting. So I think when we talk about reparations in society, it's about a loan, the denial of a home loan, the denial of a car loan, police brutality, mass incarceration, what Erica Minor calls targeted mass incarceration. Like, these are the levers for reparations. But I would argue that before I'm denied a home loan, a business loan, I'm educated in America's public schools. And when you have schools in this country that don't have drinking water, when you have schools in this country where the HVACs are doing harm, you're talking about these kids have learning disabilities. Yeah, the school is causing some of the learning disabilities. Right, well, you have, you know, teachers in Oakland were on strike last year because of the pollutants at their school. All those chemicals that we use to kill the rodents are causing breathing problems at this school. We know that 14 million kids miss school a year because of asthma. So we have to start seeing this not just as data points. For me, it's about harm and repair. And what I try to argue in the book is that, yes, we want our check, but also the fullness of reparations is to end the harm. It's to say, you can't do this to me anymore. And it's to atone for harm, to apologize, and give up your money and move out the way. So I even say in the book, you know, we can't start a reparations conversation in education and then Bill Gates talk about he the reparations scholar. Because that's what they do.
Right.
You know, what also got me involved in this, I remember being in the pandemic, sitting at home and watching CNN, and Bill Gates was on TV talking about the virus. I said, where's Fauci? Why are you here? I'm trying to see what's going on with my life. And Bill Gates is up there. And so again, right, these people who have done enormous amounts of harm will then tell us that we need them to somehow repair the harm that they have done. And then I think also where I'm looking forward to what reparations scholars have to say is that I pretty much say the wealth gap is kind of a joke. Because let's say we did the wealth gap right now, right? Every black person would get around $90,000 if we did the wealth gap right now, maybe $110,000. That's it. And nobody changes the system.
Right. Right.
Structural changes are made. All they're gonna do is raise inflation.
Right.
And that $100,000 is really gonna be like 60. And it's going to be over, and no system has been changed.
Right.
And what I also talk about in the book is every industry should be talking reparations. The medical field should be talking reparations. Right? These universities should be talking reparations. And so we can't, if we just do the wealth gap, we let them off the hook, and there's no structural changes. So the book really wants to call attention to how we can reimagine and think differently about reparations with a check, and to try to think about also transformation and change that can lead to some type of systemic changes. So 100 years from now, we're not doing reparations again because we never got the system right.
Amen. Whew, how y'all feeling? I want to make sure, because we got some books to sign and buy and all of that stuff, I want to make sure, though, we have some time for your questions.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Asantewaa Nkrumah Ture. Dr. Love, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
For all that you just described, what does that say about schools that are in neighborhoods where there's a high rate of evictions? Right now, we have a situation where two young black women have been shot during evictions by what we call landlord terrorist officers. Mm-hmm. Both are mothers of young children. Angel Davis shot in March, Latisse Bethea shot in July, and Latisse was shot in front of her daughter. And you can imagine her daughter's traumatized, in addition to whatever else is going on in our neighborhoods. So I think that in terms of how housing and education are related directly, perhaps more directly than we think, I think we should look at that as well.
No, that's a really great point. You know, I live in Atlanta. I'm not from Atlanta, but I've lived there a long time. And watching the gentrification of that city, watching black folks be pushed out of that city. Now, this is a chocolate city. Say it again?
And Cop City.
We could do a whole nother lecture on Cop City.
Word.
But watching black folks be pushed out of that city with black leadership. Everything black. And ain't nothing black. All of them. They've all sold the city up. And so now we're watching what we would call gentrification, but it's really violence, and at any extent. And so it always brings me back to what Ta-Nehisi Coates said, is that, you know, any policy is irrelevant if you don't see black people as human. It doesn't make a difference. And so the evictions, I mean, it's all part of the gutting and the attack on black life because they see it as disposable. And they don't see us as even being deserving of this land, this property, as we have built this whole damn entire thing.
Hi, Cynthia Rulak. Cited you several times in grad work, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you.
Both of you. but besides that, I just was wondering, have you been invited to Washington? Have you been invited to maybe speak so that we can actually elevate some of this legislation? Because I'm from the school of thought. I've been arguing, you know, nothing's going to change until, you know, legislation and things like that. We can argue all day, but where is the movement, I guess? So I don't know if you are trying to work on any kind of bills or where's your head in that sort of thing.
There's a great chapter in the book called Erasure, and it's the story of how the Biden administration threw me under the bus. Chapter 5, y'all. So, no, I have not worked. Real quick, the Biden administration, I run a nonprofit, co-founded a nonprofit called ATN. We put out a study guide for back to school, and the Biden administration used our study guide and their back to school, didn't tell us. We didn't know we were in their study guide. We started getting calls from Fox News and all over the place about, did you know you were included in the study guide? We were like, what are you talking about? We had to go to Google, find the study guide, then find our name in it. And you can imagine what happens when Fox News and all these folks unleash on you. We're a little nonprofit. There's like 3 people working for us, and we got the everyday coming. There's death threats and bomb threats and all types of stuff. You know, I'm in my house watching every car that come down the street. You know, it's always fascinating when they call you the N-word and say racism don't exist in this country. Okay. And then, of course, they asked the Biden administration for a comment, and they said it was a mistake. They said they never intended to put us in there, and it was a mistake.
Wait a minute. You mean a black woman created something, and a white man took it, exploited it?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm good on policy for a while. Yeah, it's, so the whole story is in there.
Hi, Dr. Love. My name is Woodland Serafin, assistant professor at the University of Texas, Arlington.
Okay.
And so my question for you is more of a personal one. As a scholar who's followed your work through grad school and now as a junior faculty member, I'm always writing and reading and I'm angry. So can you talk about how you do such thorough, complete work and like care for yourself in that process?
Thank you for that question. That's a beautiful question. I need to hear this.
So, if anybody knows me, you could talk to my doc students, you could talk to my colleagues. I don't answer emails. I think they're a waste of time. I will get back to you. Everybody's okay. Everybody is okay. Nobody has died from me not checking an email. So first of all, I prioritize my time really, really well.
You mean you don't answer emails for a certain period of time?
Yeah or no, like it depends.
Did I say what I said?
I'm gonna leave right now from TC. I'm not checking that email. I'm just not doing it. Everybody gonna be okay. So I am really clear about what I'm not gonna do. I'm very clear about that. I have boundaries. I have really good boundaries. I have no problem saying no. And I will say no, and I feel good about saying no. I'm like, I said no 3-4 times a day. Like, I'm really good about saying no. I know what brings me joy. So watching basketball, playing basketball brings me joy. I have to give you an example. I had some folks hit me up from Chicago. It was like, yo, we doing abolitionist leadership tonight on Zoom. I said, that's cool. I've been waiting all day to watch LeBron. I've been waiting all day to watch LeBron. I'm watching LeBron. Like, I know what brings me joy, and I schedule that joy. I also know that your ego will get in your way of your healing. So what I mean by that, I remember being a young faculty member and saying some stuff in a room full of white folks, and they're like, we've never thought of that before. And I'm like, for real? And if you don't check your ego, they will have you thinking you're the smartest mofo in there. But what I learned was them having you think you're the smartest mofo in there was to have to work you to death. Yes. Well, we need you on this committee. You would be great on this. Oh, my God. We need you over here. We got to have you over here. And if you don't check your ego, you're like, I need to be here. They need me over here. And then you just, all of a sudden, you want 13 committees.
And then when you go up for tenure, they'd be like, you know, you didn't do enough work. You really should have used your time better.
Right. You're like, so you have to check your ego because they would truly make you think you are needed every single where. And if y'all need me every single where, what you're saying is you need more of me. Hire more black women. Hire more black people. Stop working me to death. So I'm very clear. My doc students will tell you, I don't work on Fridays. Now, what I do with my time is my time, but I'm not doing nothing on Fridays. Don't email me on Fridays. Don't call me on Fridays. I'm not working on Fridays. That's my day. My weekend starts Thursday night. I'm not working on Fridays. And let me be really clear, like I have two kids. This weekend we went ziplining. I got back from this tour, we went ziplining. We watched Princess and the Bride last night. That's the first time I watched that. We watched theater camp last night to 12 o'clock in the morning. My son had a test we had to study for. So I got a family, and I want to be around as long as the good Lord will have me. And so I am just very clear about this is what I want to do with my life. This is the time that I want to use it. And I'm not playing around with these folks. I joke and say this to myself. Only thing I got in common with a white man is 24 hours. He got the same 24 I got. And I want my 24.
I know that's right. We have time for one more question.
My sis. We go way back, like way back.
I don't know. This is really just coming back from the Georgia piece, right? Because I was just like, oh my God, you're not at Georgia, University of Georgia anymore. And I think about the work you're doing and really the attacks that started in Georgia really quietly over the last, like, I don't know, good 10 years since the takeover. And I'm wondering if you could talk about, like, what it is to do this work in a place that is hostile. And I can't say that UGA and your department was hostile, but the state was hostile to this type of work. And so I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about, like, the politics of, like, trying to live and do this work in that location.
Yeah, you know, I think it really comes down to community. I think it really comes down to being grassroots and with folk who are doing this work, because at the end of the day, these universities will throw you away. They will act like they don't know you. And you have to be ready for that. You got to have your exit plan always. When I left Georgia, I needed 6 boxes. That's all I needed. My office was never, you could be like, you could leave today. I could leave today. I was always very clear that this is a university. This is a transactional relationship. Because I saw at the University of Georgia, and this is at many universities, I remember there was a black woman who died of cancer, and that was it. Other black women got a plaque, and they moved on. And so if you are going to dedicate your life to the university, that's where they got you. It's about dedicating your life to the cause, to the people, to the community. So being in Georgia, for me, wasn't as hostile as many other places. It's because I was very clear about our relationship. I wasn't surprised that they put, like, they would put me on a shelf when it was time to take me out. And then after that, they put me right back in. And that was fine because that means they didn't bother me. So I was really happy with that. And when the attacks came, I will say UGA stepped up and said she can do what she want to do on her own time. Now, they didn't say they agree with me. They didn't say they backed me, but they did say she can do what she wants to do on her own time. And I was thankful for that. But I also know that there are many colleagues that I have that are being told they can't talk about race, they can't talk about abolition, they can't talk about anti-racism. So I was really happy to get out of Georgia when I did. When TC called me, I was trying to act like I had options. Right? You know, I was trying to negotiate, like, I'll think it over. Like, I was leaving. But I was trying to act like I had options. So it was just serendipitous to get that call at that time. But I'm really thankful, but I'm also scared for my colleagues who are back in Georgia still trying to do this work. But, you know, it'll be fugitivity. We've always done it. We always going to do it. And they can ban whatever they want to ban. They ain't never going to black creativity. They ain't going to never ban blackness. They ain't never going to... By time they ban it, we done moved on. I mean, it's just like woke. We ain't even saying that no more.
Right. We've been off that.
We've been off that. Y'all still talking about woke? Like, we never really pop with that anyway. So, you know, I just know that we going to keep doing what we're always doing. And I just believe that if everybody just does their part, we get to the promised land. And whatever that is with queer folks and trans folks and black folks, with folks of color and all of us, we get there faster if we all could just do our part.
Another thing that they can't ban is black brilliance, and that is you. This book right here is a special book. It's already made an important intervention. You say you staying away from policy, but policy ain't gonna stay away from you. This book is gonna matter.
I appreciate that.
And everybody that reads it, all these students, all these scholars, all these politicians, they might read it and pretend they didn't read it, but it's gonna inform our conversations, it's gonna inform our policies, and it's gonna enlighten a whole bunch of folk. And I just wanna say, and I should have started with this, this book is already a New York Times bestseller. Number six. But we don't want one of them 1 week bestsellers. You know, one of them Candace Owens. Oh wait, sorry. Somebody who will remain nameless who buys their own books. Any random person who buys their own books and gets the number. We want this to be a perpetual bestseller that comes up from the grassroots, that shows that teachers and students and families and politicians care about this work and value what Bettina Love puts into the world. So I'm going to ask you all, as you go out there, to support Bettina, to support this book. I know y'all know a teacher that needs this. Grab one for them. They'll pay you back. Some of y'all got some family that need to read this, pay it back. One of y'all got them, one of them right-wing friends that don't understand. This is set them right. Make sure you get a book for them too. But seriously, Bettina, we love you. We're grateful for you. Thank you for taking the time and the energy to make something this special.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.